Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm your pitmaster, your meat and potatoes, your lambykins, and very clearly a pretty big ham, David Santo. And this episode is about veganism. No, not that. It's more about animal flesh and eating it, though sometimes not, as well as technocracy, artisanship, and of course, power. In fact, veganism does come up if you listen all the way to the end. In any case, there will be a fair bit to chew on, and in deference to my sister, I've tried to cut out the gristle. But before I turn on the gas and pull the bavette out of its marinade, turn your oral attention to this. That was the sound of non-enzymatic browning, amino acids searing, and deliciousness in formation. It was, of course, a piece of meat in a fry pan, sizzling in reaction to the heat underneath and forming an oh-so-lovely crust between the tender tissue inside and the residual seasonings that adhered to the surface. In episode 1's food questionnaire, Sandeep Bhagwati said that maillardability was his favorite quality in a meat. By that, he meant the capacity of animal flesh to turn brown and tasty through the Maillard reaction. It's named for the French chemist Louis-Camille Maillard, who first described it in 1912, and it's a process that involves amino acids and certain sugars being transformed into melanoidins, another compound that gives many brown foods their specific flavor. Caramelization, which is what happens to sugars under high heats, is a different process, though it, of course, also adds aroma and taste to many foods. The flavor molecules, melanoidins, are present in breads and toasted marshmallows and roasted coffee, malted grains, and a lot of other foods. And though they're certainly wonderful in the mouth, they may also be associated with some less than happy health conditions. In any case, maillardability is only one of the things that makes meat such a, well, meaty subject. Throughout history, animal flesh, indeed animal-derived foods of all sorts, have been associated with wealth and power and high social status. Meat is, of course, costly to produce because animals have to be provided with feed themselves, so there's a second layer of agricultural energies that are involved. Meat production is also extremely water-intensive, both while the animal is alive, as well as during slaughter, during butchery, and then in the ongoing secondary and tertiary transformation of its byproducts. Some estimates state that to produce 1 kilogram of beef, it takes 15,000 liters of water. In imperial units, that's 1,800 gallons of water for 1 pound of meat. Plants also take a whole lot of water to produce, especially when we're talking about large-scale industrial farming, but compared to animals, they are massively less demanding. This is also one of the reasons that water has now become one of the most hotly contested global trade and environmental issues, and why reducing our collective meat consumption and adopting more agroecological production methods is so critical right now. As many of us know, however, our collective meat consumption volume on the planet is not going down, and it's in fact doing quite the opposite. Despite the fact that different countries are witnessing different kinds of movement in terms of carnivory, the pressure for more animal production continues. Urbanization and globalization and industrialization all contribute their own momentum to that meat machine, even in places that have historically had much more plant-based diets. So why is this? Well, meat's historic unaffordability is precisely what makes it so desirable. It's one of the many reasons, anyway. As a food that used to be available on a regular basis only to the elite classes, it's a clear symbol of privilege and wealth. Eating meat means eating rich. And aspirationally, a large majority of the world's population would like to be rich. Today, with economies of scale, crossbreeding for productivity, intensive animal raising facilities, and lots of very intensively produced feed and other inputs, meat is being grown more inexpensively than ever. And that's not actually a good thing. There are many, many very good documentaries and online reports about why meat production is so problematic, so I won't get into all of that detail here. But suffice it to say, meat is a deeply chewy issue, and it's one that just can't be resolved easily. eating meat, not eating meat, eating better meat, eating meat substitutes, defending meat, accusing meat, producing meat in feedlots and in laboratory reactors, and abstaining from meat conversations altogether are all deeply personal and identity-driven choices. But there are also ones that are heavily influenced by millennia and millennia of food culture and political forces. This episode's conversations wheel in and out of several different themes, adding perhaps a few new ideas to your internal debate on meat and meat eating. We poke skewers into the technocratic solutions of Silicon Valley, and then try to digest the speculative fictions of authors and filmmakers. We celebrate the care and attention of very high-quality charcuterie and cured meat, and we wonder afterwards how language and habits with meat intersect with and construct each other. Maxime and I take a somewhat restrained approach to sticking things in our mouths and reflect on how our perceptions of meat have evolved throughout our lives. And in a kind of serendipitous response to all this, a thoughtful and passionate scientist tells us why meat isn't for her during the food questionnaire. Kicking things off is Dr. Julie Guthman, a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Her research focuses on food system transformation in the United States, and most recently, she's been the principal investigator of the UC AFTER project, a multi-campus collaboration investigating Silicon Valley's activity in food and agriculture. Her award-winning book, Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry, came out in 2019, and this summer, the University of California Press will publish her new book, The Problem with Solutions, Why Silicon Valley Can't Hack the Future of Food. So thank you again so much for being here, Julie. It's a delight to have you on the podcast. I've admired your work for a long time. And one of the things I admire so much about it is the way that you put things together. You make connections in the world of food. Particularly lately, you've been making connections from things like food justice to the technology sector's involvement in food. Can you tell me how you've come to make those connections?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is all of my research ends with a new question that makes me follow a new something else. So there's part of it is just like making the connections between projects. I end with a question or conundrum, and it leads me into another area. But I think, largely I see my work as mainly looking at efforts to transform food production and distribution to have it be more ecologically sustainable and socially just. So my interest in the tech sector came from a more recent project, my last project, which is now several years old, but it was on strawberry production in California. And the issue there is that strawberry growers for about 60 years have been relying on highly toxic soil fumigants that kills a bunch of soil pathogens and weeds and nematodes in soil, the most famous of which was methyl bromide, which is an ozone-depleting substance that was phased out from the Montreal Protocol. And so I started doing that research at the end of the methyl bromide phase out, and when another chemical that was supposed to replace it came in, and it was highly controversial because it was actually more toxic than methyl bromide. So I became really curious in what growers were going to do in this new climate, and so that was the basis of the research project. One of the things they were looking at was the use of soilless substrate as a solution, or even going completely indoors.
So this would be things like more like hydroponics or using coconut fiber.
Right. So the soilless substrate would be like coconut coir or peat or something like that. And tabletop production to bring it off the ground and possibly indoors. And the contradiction there, great, particularly if they bring it indoors and they can use fewer chemicals, which I'm all for. But then the irony there is California's main competitive advantage in strawberry growing is the sandy soils and the temperate coastal climate that allows strawberry growers to produce
natural environment
10 months of the year. Because it's like on the coast, it's like eternal spring. We get the natural air conditioning of the Pacific Ocean. And so that's why California strawberries are in the market, you know, all the time, as opposed to many other places. There's a 3-week season for strawberries. So this solution was basically undercutting what made most growers viable. And the other thing they were looking at was robotics to pick strawberries.
So the replacement of human labor with mechanized labor.
Yeah, right. Because of a labor shortage, and they still haven't ironed it out because strawberries are very delicate. So anyways, this got me kind of interested in the technology. And then I kind of caught wind of this emerging interest of Silicon Valley to get into food. And so I went, really out of curiosity, I went to this event in San Francisco put on by this organization called Food Bytes. That's B-Y-T-E-F, right?
Right, as in
so
the tech.
That's the pun. And I think it was maybe the second year they did this, and it was at this kind of urban winery in this gentrified neighborhood of San Francisco. It was kind of mind-blowing. I mean, I went to this event, and people are have tables, and then later there's a whole series of funding pitches, and the solutions were just batty to me. There was one, like a protein bar that was going to solve malnutrition in Africa, and I'm like, so what, you're going to bring protein bars? I actually didn't understand what they were talking about. And it turns out the plan was really to create growers co-ops, women's growers co-ops, to harvest and process moringa, which would go into protein bars that would be sold to Whole Foods type shoppers. And then there was just a bunch of things that, like, what is this a solution to? What's the problem? Mm. So I just became really interested in, you know, all of a sudden the tech sector was the one to solve the problem, and they're getting tons of funding and tons of attention. And so anyway, that became the basis of a big research project that we just are wrapping up.
It's not entirely surprising that there's money and attention focused on technology and food, because there's been so many successes and so much value created out of different technological applications in many different ways. Not to say that all technocratic solutions can solve all problems. And in fact, very often technocratic solutions produce problems, as you've pointed out, including now in the world of meat production, which is another area that you've been spending some time in. So what are you seeing that's going on right now in terms of tech and meat and the technology solutions or the proposed solutions to what we're seeing is this increased demand for meat around the planet?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, just in general, I think a lot of these solutions are mismatched to the problems and misunderstand the problems. Why don't you start with, like, what a real problem is? So I think that, like, the dramatic big problem statement substitutes for real research on the problem. Now, alternative protein's interesting because I do think a lot of the alternative protein entrepreneurs are fairly serious about what they see as a problem. And that includes inhumane conditions in livestock production, which I completely concur with. Conventional livestock production is environmentally problematic, whether it's methane emissions or the use of antibiotics that cause antibiotic resistance, or the water quality or the air quality. So I don't disagree with that as a problem. They kind of downplay the inhumane conditions because they don't want to offend people. But what's interesting is that, you know, they're in the business of trying to sell a product, and they fundamentally don't believe that any sort of regulation will work, or they just don't want to do that because they want to sell a product. And so their idea of how to solve this problem is to produce products that simulate existing animal products.
So trying to make pea protein into steaks.
Yeah, right.
Or hamburgers anyway.
Fungi into steaks, or to make impossible burgers. And they really, really work hard on the technology of making these things smell like, taste like, bleed like meat, even though honestly, any one of them tastes really different than another. So none of them are really getting it. But the idea is that they don't believe that the public will stop eating animal products. And so they kind of have to fake them into being vegan through things that are just like them. The other, of course, critical product here is the development of cellular meats. Rather than using vegan products or plant-based products to simulate animal products, they are trying to grow animal products without the animal.
So this is what we sometimes call lab meat or cell-cultured meat, yeah.
Yeah, lab meat. So they're basically taking biopsies of animals and trying to grow them first in little petri dishes and eventually in bioreactors. And this is a technology that's now allowable in the United States. It's recently been approved, but it hasn't really been commercialized.
Making it actually feel like you're eating meat, it may even look or cook a little bit like it, but it's never going to be quite the same thing. It's not, it certainly at this point is not the same thing.
Yeah. Their claims to environmental sustainability are like kind of are really based on this idea that they can use less land, less water, less energy and grow it in these really contained spaces of the bioreactor. And what they don't talk about is if you're to scale up these technologies for everybody to eat them, it would take a ton of resources.
Right. So the carbon footprint of tank meat is going to be as large at this point anyway as growing animals on growing flesh on animals.
Energy resources to heat and cool them and to electrify the facility. You need all sorts of ore to build the bioreactors. And you need to feed the stuff. Something doesn't grow from nothing. So they really invisibilize where the material will come from, as if it's only going to grow in a bioreactor. And probably the most truthful thing I ever heard was somebody from a cellular meat company. This is somebody I talked to at an event maybe 5 years ago who said it would take a bioreactor the size of a blue whale to serve every person in San Francisco, so that's about 700,000 people, one burger per week. So imagine, you know, if they're eating burgers every night.
That's a lot of bioreactors.
A lot of landscapes. And so I think there's this kind of sleight of hand where they're talking about how they don't use this, they don't use that, but they don't talk about what materials they are going to use and where they're going to come from.
So there's a lot of sort of surface solutions or things are being made to look relatively straightforward or simple or successful, whereas underneath the surface, there's an awful lot of issues that are going on, not just complex, but sometimes so complicated that this won't be a solution in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and the other, like the one that kind of gets me with the cellular meat also is they say, well, we're only growing the steak. We're only growing the part of the animal that people want that's more efficient. But indeed, every bit of those animals are used.
Yeah. And they go into food products, but also non-food products. And it's critical to have a lot of those. Gelatin is in so many different elements of so many.
Yeah. It's in everything. My colleague, Alex Blanchette, has written a book called Porkopolis that I strongly recommend. It's probably one of my favorite books I've read.
It's a great book.
10 years. Right. And the stuff from pig, it's everywhere. It's in the covers of our book. It's in the cement. It's everywhere. They don't waste at all.
This making meat in a lab and isolating it from the animal, isolating it from the context of the land and isolating it from the rest of the downstream industry is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
One of the critiques that I hear often about lab-grown meat or cellular cultured meat or even pea protein-based meat substitutes, meat alternatives, is that it's creating two classes of protein. One, ultimately, the kind of meat that's grown on animals is going to be for the wealthy class.
Yeah.
And the kind of meat that's grown in other places is going to be for another class of citizen who may be paying less, maybe not being given permission to have the same kind of gustatory pleasure from eating flesh on and off an animal. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I think that's probably right. It makes me think of, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, is the relationship between what Silicon Valley does and speculative fiction. And if you think of the movie Soylent Green, and there's another one called Snowpiercer, that's a similar theme where, you know, it's post-apocalyptic, the world has collapsed, and people in Soylent Green, people are eating these wafers originally made from soy and lentil. And dare I do the spoiler alert? The end of the movie, we discover that human corpses are going into the Soylent. But there's scenes of the elites eating steak and drinking wine or having a jar of strawberry jam for $80. And Snowpiercer has a very similar.
Yeah, where there's this sort of, that's the cockroaches that are turned into jelly tablets that are then being fed to the people in the lower class train cars. And in fact, going back as far back as 1951, 52, Frederick Pohl published one of the very first things called a science fiction novel called The Space Merchants, in which tank meat was the food of the poor.
Yeah.
And people were being sent off planet to work in vertical algae farms to feed, to create the algae that was being then fed to the beast called Chicken Little. So this has been thought about for a very long time.
So the techies want to replicate the horrors of speculative fiction. Having said that, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that's fascinating, but I'm not sure that's really going to happen, or at least anytime soon. Because this other thing I've been thinking about is this decline in actually some of the companies that came out, you know, that some of them have gone bankrupt. Some of them have dropped their sales. One cellular meat company already went out of business. This is also happening with vertical farming, too. The popular understandings is that, you know, people were excited about eating an Impossible Burger or whatever. Or the fast food joints didn't want to have to have a separate cooking, you know, when they're just putting stuff out all the time and they would need to cook these things individually because there wasn't a lot of demand for them. But ultimately, these things have to compete with existing food production. And our existing food production is so cheap that they actually can't compete. And so the only way that these would ever succeed is if there's true ecological collapse or there's more regulation of the meat industry so they can't, or any other industry, so they can't produce it so cheaply. And that's the biggest irony, is because they're investing this stuff because they don't think regulation is a political possibility. And yet the only way, or one of the only two ways they will be successful, is if you regulate existing food production so it is more costly, and so therefore their substitutes might be competitive.
So it's a wonderful perversion. I didn't realize that so many businesses doing alternative meats were going out of business, but the idea that the social critique has been that these kinds of meats will be for the less wealthy, it's in fact only the wealthy who are able to afford them at the beginning because the system is set up for cheap meat. Well, so tell me, you mentioned it, and it's one of the things I always love about your writing, is the humor, the irony, the poking fun, the wink and the nod, as well as the very serious critique of what's going on. How do you manage to maintain humor and irony in your work while there are so many horrible things to be looked at?
I think my first impulse is to be snarky, honestly, and so often I have to tamp it down. But I have an eye toward irony. I mean, there's one thing about being humorous and snarky, and sometimes I have people who review my work say, I love this writing, it's so lively, it's funny, and then some people are like, this is not very scholarly and serious. That's a matter of taste. But when I publish books, generally the publisher's like, yeah, go for it. They like the humor. So that just comes to me. And I can't plan my humor. It comes like when I teach, things spill out of my mouth and I say to myself, did I really just say that?
Well, I love it. Thank you so much for having the time to talk to me and sharing all these great perspectives. It will be exciting to read your book when it comes in print. It'll be out in the summer of 2024.
I believe so. Yeah. July or August, I think.
We will look for it. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. That was very fun.
And do check out the show notes for links to other examples of Julie's wit and wisdom on food, including an excerpt of her article, The Food Police, Why Michael Pollan Made Me Want to Eat Cheetos, as well as an appearance on the Thriving Farmer podcast, in which she talks more about the California strawberry industry. Up next, we step behind the butcher block with Philippe Vien, the owner and creative force behind Aliment Vien, a fine food shop in Montreal that specializes in some very fine meat products indeed. Phil is a trained chef and a talented charcutier, meaning a maker of charcuterie, and he has been a leading light in the Montreal food scene for more than 15 years. During the COVID pandemic, I found great solace in the aperitivos for one that I made on many evenings, using his excellent saucisson sec, Montreal mortadella, and silky culatello. Whether or not I was imagining it during those months of shut-in, I felt a very strong sense of care and presence in the thinly sliced meats. Their edible company was very much appreciated. So, Phil, thank you so much for coming into my home studio. I feel a bit like I've got a charcuterie rock star in my house. It's like, ooh, it's so exciting. But thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, and I'll just start right off with, you know, tell me about the shop. Tell me about Aliment Vien and how it came into being. It's an incredible place, and it is really kind of a leader in charcuterie production in Montreal. It's well known. You have a loyal following, but I'd love to know a bit about the history and how it came into being.
Thanks. So Aliment Vien, we opened the shop just about 6 years ago. It actually came about far before that. I've probably been running the company for about 8 years. A couple of false starts kind of producing in different spaces. And it came about, I used to be a chef. I worked in restaurants for 12, 15 years. There were many restaurants in Montreal. I worked at L'Express, and then I worked at an old restaurant which doesn't exist anymore called DNA, and was the chef at the recently closed Maison Publique for the first 3-4 years. And in cooking, I specialized throughout my career kind of in meat cooking and meat productions like butchery, producing charcuterie, different things. And eventually I started a family and realized that my very fast-paced, no-sleep lifestyle wasn't going to cut it. And I started looking at, you know, different ways that I could express myself and my creativity and what I knew how to do, use my experience. And I came up with being a butcher and a charcuterie producer.
Well, it's a fabulous benefit to all of us. I'm glad you had a family because we get to enjoy the outcome of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, yeah.
The foods you produce, I mean, there's an incredible range. It's very traditional in some ways in terms mm-hmm. of the charcuterie range, very French influenced, Italian influenced. But you've also been like the first person I've ever witnessed in Montreal producing Nduja. Mm-hmm. There was super spicy Southern Italian charcuterie, but it's something a little bit different. But that's a lot of different inspirations, it feels yeah. like. Where do you get your inspiration?
I mean, basically, like New World, essentially, you know, like I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself European in any sense whatsoever. My dad's like Quebecois, my mom's Métis, so we're very traditional North American, I guess, family. And I feel like one of the great things about that is that with, you know, the waves of people coming over, I don't feel particularly tied to any one tradition. So what I try and do is kind of match up my personal experiences in food and then also the experience of food in Montreal and use that as the tools to build kind of a selection of products. There aren't a lot of players, you know, who are making kind of traditional artisanal charcuterie in Quebec at all. So
yeah. Well, and artisanal is the word, right? It is extremely well crafted. It is very much the attention to detail.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly it. Yeah, that's it. Right.
Well, and you mentioned that your mother is Métis also. Yeah. Is there any kind of, for listeners who are not familiar with the landscape of Indigenous culture in Canada or in the place that we can now call Canada, yeah. Métis is one of the, or Métis and Métis for a woman is one of yeah. the groupings of Indigenous people. So is that an influence in your food? Is your mother's history part of your history as well?
You know, it is, but I'm not from Manitoba. I didn't grow up surrounded by Métis people. You know, obviously a lot of the food culture that I have is from my parents and grandparents, like everyone else. You know, it could be said as being a very like French Canadian food way. Like we ate a lot of the same things that Quebecois people eat when you're a kid. Right. Very meat focused, a lot of pork, which was interesting because I grew up on the West Coast, actually, in a suburb of Vancouver. And there wasn't a lot of pork options in grocery stores. So, you know, if you went to like your regular IGA or whatever, you know, you might get pork chops, but you probably wouldn't get anything else. We had to, you know, she had to go out of her way to find ground pork and pig's feet and stuff so to be able to make what we would eat.
I used to live next to the wonderful old grocery store, Sakaris, on Santa Fe Boulevard, which is now unfortunately closed. But it was, you know, a combination of Portuguese and Vietnamese food influences, and you ended up with all the pork things you could possibly
want. Yeah, that's right.
Want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it is rare to find it in any supermarket, really, particularly if you're in a suburban, well, sort of white, middle-class, Western European type consumer culture. It's not going to give you the pork uterus if you were looking for
that. That's right. That's right. Exactly.
Given that meat has been such a focus of your work, both when you were a restaurant cook and now that you're a charcutier, and as meat prices are climbing pretty radically at some points in the current period, does that pose a risk? Does that make you think that consumers will be buying less meat, more meat, higher quality meat less often? What are you seeing from your point of view?
I definitely say that, you know, most of the butcher shops that I know, definitely, especially in the last like year since we've tapered off of a pandemic and are heading into what could be a recession, you know, people are definitely buying a little less, being a little bit more frugal with what they're buying. You know, I'm really, like you said earlier, I have a great clientele that are very regular and loyal, and people are still coming, and people who search out quality, which I like to think are people who come to my shop, will always search out quality, and they'll, even if they buy less, they will still go for quality. I think as far as the larger market implications are concerned, we're definitely going to see dips in consumption of, you know, especially the higher priced meat products. I think beef is going to be on a decline. But to be honest, meat consumption has actually been on a downward plane for decades. So my bet, even from the onset of the company, was that people are going to step further and further away from industrial production and, you know, closer and closer to, you know, small farms, artisanal production, you know, a more local stance, a smaller carbon footprint, which is obviously a really big issue also in the industry. So,
well, and certainly because you're located on Saint-Laurent Boulevard in Montreal, which is such a historic place for largely immigrant food originally. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of stopping off point for many, many different immigrant groups over the history of Montreal before they then would migrate into other neighborhoods. But it still retains that strong food tradition, even if it's changing a lot of the old shops are still not there. But you, in some ways, you benefit from being one of the new generation of kind of traditionalists who are now reinstalling that sense of food culture on Saint-Laurent. Do you have a, I mean, that's my perspective. Does it feel like that to you when you're, that you are part of this regeneration or new generation or continuing generation of food artisans on Saint-Laurent Boulevard?
Yeah, it does. On Saint-Laurent Boulevard, to be honest, maybe a little less specific to the street. I think that's something that kind of came a little bit later. You know, once the shop was established, I kind of started realizing that was a thing. But in general, you know, it was definitely part of my decision-making process in kind of early on in the company and in just what I'm doing in general, that, you know, we can take these amazing traditional products that are really delicious and that have a really high value culturally, and just bring it into now and into the future.
Do you still think of yourself as particularly focused on charcuterie, or is it the larger range of high quality food products that you're selling that have become more interesting to you?
I mean, I've definitely always had an interest in really good food, which is a big part of what we do. To be honest, the food products, like the kind of grocery section, was really just an adaptation during COVID. Not to say that I don't love it, because I do. And even when, you know, we were setting it up, I was really happy to start having all these cool products and to be able to kind of, you know, share them with people and I mean, obviously sell them, but feel more like a butcher and charcuterie producer. But that changes over time, and that's good too.
I remember being there and thinking, oh, look at all this great, you know, there were vinegars, there were soy sauces, mm-hmm. there were olive oils, there were canned fish. It made me think, oh, okay, if these are in fill shops, I'm going to want to buy them. And I was like, oh, $24 for a bottle of vinegar? Sure. And indeed, I bought it, and it remains to this day the very best vinegar I've ever had in my entire life. Yeah. And I thought, oh, okay, I can trust these products because I know Phil's making this meat and he's approving these products, that there's a kind of seal of approval on them. So I think you were doing a service to all of us, because I'd never seen the vinegar before. I haven't seen it since, but it lives in my body. It's just an amazing taste experience.
Yeah, cheers. Yeah, that's, you know, it's one of the ways that we choose products. I don't know if, you know, even if it wasn't the original reason why we started carrying these products, it's definitely something that we do. And I do appreciate that, the trust that's built with people.
And in fact, you know, one of the other things that I really trust you on is fat, because a lot of your cured meats and charcuterie have a lot of fat in them. And I love animal fat. I think it's important to eat animal fat, but certainly lots of people are afraid of fat. And on, you know, things like culatello or prosciutto, where the fat is part of the food, you're supposed to eat it, but lots of people I know cut it off because they don't like the extra white bit on their meat. But do you feel like there's more of an acceptance of fat because you're making it, or that people trust you because the fat will be good?
I think it's an acquired taste, to be honest. You know, something that you learn. I think if you grow up eating a lot of, you know, grow up not afraid of the fat, then that's one thing culturally, but it's definitely, you know, a problem for a lot of people, I can say. Still a problem for a lot of people. I know, you know, usually when new customers come to the shop, there's some finger pointing and, you know, kind of questioning and asking if they, you know, how much of the fat can we cut off for them? And, you know, we try and find balance. You know, it's like any business, you kind of have to find balance between what you believe or what you want and then what your customers want. So, yeah, we do definitely get a lot of people griping on the fat, unfortunately. But that's what happens when you've, you know, decades of people telling you you shouldn't eat fat.
And right.
Now it's, you know, that rhetoric is changing and we're deciding that fat's a good thing to eat. I personally don't, you know, shy away from it, but it's definitely a challenge.
Yeah. Well, and it has to do with all of the tastes and distastes that we have for all of our foods and what we've grown up learning and unlearning. Right. And hopefully you are part of the great new wave of education that fat is good.
Yeah, that's right.
Not too much, a lot.
That's right. And it's always about reminding people that it's energy like anything else. So as long as you eat it with moderation, like you should everything, then it's no problem.
Yeah. So tell me, what are your favorite things to make? Or actually, let me start with this. What are your least favorite things to make that you keep making because there's such a constant demand for it?
Oh, wow. I mean, I really like what I do. So it's nothing really is a chore. I'd say like specific tasks is more what it is, because, you know, the way that we produce things, we're constantly making kind of everything all the time. You know, you do a lot more of a specific task than you do of some others. Like just grinding meat is a thing. So, you know, like mortadella has this very long, we don't use a chopper. We grind. So it's like a progressive grind. It gets ground multiple times. Okay. It takes hours to make a batch of mortadella. And I actually really enjoy making it, but I know that the other guys at the shop sometimes don't love it so much. That and things like sausage stuffing, just because it's the same repetitive task for hours and hours and hours. And we don't make tons. Our production is pretty small, but we still make, you know, 100 to 200 kilos of sausage a week. So yeah, it's a lot.
It's repetitive.
It's repetitive.
Does it become meditative or is it just more?
It can, if you let it, but you know, like all things, it can just be boring. Yeah. It really depends. I get lost in my head and I love it. So making the mortadella, I listen to a podcast, kind of just in the fridge. So we just put in little headphones. So we're not going to talk to any customers. Or that's it. Meditate. Think about anything else.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to know that mortadella can be meditative. It is, of course, one of my favorites that you make. Yeah, what are your favorites? What's most sort of fun or satisfying or thrilling for you?
I mean, the most thrilling thing, to be honest, is to see people's reaction when they eat something and then, you know, have them really like it. That's still, you know, even I've been cooking for decades, it's still kind of the greatest thrill of doing what I do. But as far as products, I'd say like the long aged things are like really fun. They're not necessarily the most complicated, but you know, you mentioned culatello earlier. Culatello is a huge pleasure I find to make. There's a lot of craft that goes into it, and you have to let it sit for at least a year. So, you know, you don't really see your results for a very, very long time. Yeah. It's kind of one of those things. The learning curve is actually really, really slow because, you know, before you can make adjustments, you have to wait like, you know, 14 to 18 months.
Right. So. All right. Next year, I'll
figure
it
out. That's right.
And there's also, there must be sort of some excitement or anticipation. There they are hanging up in I guess it's in a cooling drying fridge.
That's right.
Yeah. And they're just waiting.
Yeah.
And you have to wait along with them.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I think, you know, patience is definitely key. I think that's probably one of the biggest problems with, you know, I see kind of like young people are starting to make, you know, charcuterie or dry aged products. And they're just not willing, you know, not willing. They're just too excited to get to it, which I totally understand. But you really just got to give it time to do its thing.
Yeah. Well, and always have something made a year and a half ago.
Yeah,
so
that yeah that's right.
Opening
that's
up right. The next product.
Yeah. The first year and a half at the shop was a little slow.
So what is next for the shop? You've been around for 6 years.
Yeah.
You've been transitioning from sort of one chunk of your career to another chunk of your career. Do you see another chunk coming up, or is Vienna going to be around forever? What's the future?
I mean, I'd like to think Vienna is going to be around forever. I, like most companies, growth is key in the way that our economic system works. So, you know, definitely looking to the future and hoping for some growth. I don't exactly know what form that's going to take yet, but I am looking forward to whatever it brings, to be honest. I think it's, you know, it's exciting. I mean, now that we're kind of through a lot of diversity, say, over the last like few years, I'm looking forward to kind of hopefully maybe, you know, actual growth rather than just sustenance.
Right. Well, let's cross our fingers for
that's
everybody.
Right. That's right. Exactly.
It's a little unclear what the future is about to bring. So you mentioned when you first showed up here that you were also an artist. Tell me about that. What are the ways do you make beautiful things?
I paint and draw with pastel and do some like traditional beadwork. Well, not really traditional, but traditional methods, say.
Does it have a parallel to the meat making in your mind or in your body, or is it a very different kind of process?
It is similar in ways. So obviously the techniques and everything are completely different, but the creativity is something that I learned as I started doing this. It's something I picked up a little bit later on in my life. You know, creativity is creativity, And, you know, finding ways to express yourself is really magical. Personally, I find a lot of pleasure and peace with it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So.
And do you make art about food, or do you reserve the food for the food?
I sometimes make art about food. I don't usually, not a lot of it. It's mostly kind of things that are close to me or important to me in other ways. But every once in a while, who doesn't love to draw a sausage?
Yeah. Including the fabulous sausage that is your logo. We love the logo. Geez. And that logo will show up in the show notes, along with other information and links about Phil and Edmond Vien. Phil, thanks so much for being here. It's been just a real pleasure and kind of a thrill to talk to you in my own home.
Thank you very much for having me again. And it was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Cheers.
To gaze lovingly at the products that Phil and his team produce at Vien, and to see that famous sausage logo, check out the show notes for links and details.
Maxim.
Hello, David.
Can I tell you, it is very nice to meet you.
Yes. Well, I think we met a while ago.
I know, but we're going to meet again right now.
Oh, is that a play on words?
It might be. Yes, of course. We're doing a meat tasting for this episode of Stick This in Your Mouth.
I see. Hence the play on words.
Yeah. You are, I think, quite a substantial meat eater, aren't you?
Yes.
Do you qualify yourself as a carnivore?
Yes, I am a carnivore.
Are you a vegivore too?
Yes, I like veggies as well.
Uh-huh. Are you a frugivore?
Yes, I am.
Are you a fruitarian?
Oh, what is a fruitarian?
Fruitarian is somebody who only eats fruits and vegetables that have fallen off of the plant by themselves. They are not harvested. So it's all about not killing things. It's a more specific form of eating.
No. If I am, it's by accident.
Yes. Have you ever been a vegetarian or a vegan?
No.
Have you ever been a flexitarian?
Isn't flexitarian someone that eats meat from time to time?
Yes. It's sort of like, I don't eat meat, but yeah, sometimes I do.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was a flexitarian for a while. When I lived in California, it seemed to make sense for a while, and then it kind of got boring, and I just decided I would eat whatever I eat. But I do eat less meat. Mm-hmm. I used to eat less meat. Now that we're together, I'm eating a lot of meat again.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that is?
From the get-go, like, there was always meat at every meal.
Mm-hmm. This is family culture?
Yeah, it's family culture. And I also, I enjoy eating meat.
Yeah.
But rarely nowadays eat red meat.
Yeah, if we have a steak, it's almost always a bavette on salad, sliced thin, and not too much of it.
Yeah, exactly. No big T-bone, very little lamb, very
rib roast.
We lean towards the white meats.
Yeah. Well, and ground beef for pasta sauce stuff. What do you think about eating meat? Like, what are your thoughts on it for you, for the people, for the planet, for the world, for animals?
We'll have to not eliminate it, but reduce our consumption because it is extremely damaging to the planet.
Yeah.
Yes, we do eat meat, but we try. I consciously try to not eat as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm. Like smaller portions or less frequently?
Small portion. We try to integrate also
some veg meals.
Some vegetarian meals.
I don't think of them as vegetarian meals. I just think of them as like
meatless
meals that we didn't put meat into.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's one of the things, like, so much of the planet historically has been vegetarian or has not been vegetarian. Vegetarian is like a term to describe people who don't eat meat after meat became a kind of standard thing to eat. Because meat is so symbolic of power and wealth. And so to actively abstain from eating meat is a kind of a political statement.
Mm-hmm.
But what about animal ethics? Do you think about the ways that animals were raised and human treatment of animals?
Yes.
Does that affect your pleasure in eating meat?
Well, I would try to source the meat that we eat from a really good butcher. My previous butcher, you'd have the provenance of the farm where the meat and the way that the how do you call like a group of animals?
The herd.
A herd was fed. And I think the butcher that we have is also trying to be mindful. But I will not buy something if I don't know the provenance of it. So,
well, and we're stuck a bit, right? Because we can only shop at the places we can shop. And so we don't really have that much control unless we are sourcing out a meat farmer directly and having a conversation with him or her. And the other challenge with meat is even if you know that the farm is raising it well, you don't know how it was slaughtered because most farms do not have their own slaughterhouses, particularly at the scale that we would like to buy meat from. And then once they go through the industrial slaughterhouse system, we're reintroducing a lot of stress and damage to the animal. So it's a very messed up situation, and it's hard to extract ourselves from it as relatively average consumers.
Yeah.
Okay, so in light of all this delicious sadness, we're going to eat a very small piece of meat. And as we often do, we eat a lot of cured meats, high quality cured meats from charcutier and producers in Montreal and around Montreal. And this time it's actually directly in Montreal. This is another taste treat from our friend Nick.
Yes.
In this case, it's cured duck breast that he's cured like prosciutto.
Ooh.
So we have some very thin slices of beautiful dark, dark red meat with a big old layer of white fat on
it. It looks gorgeous.
Yeah, and it looks good enough to eat,
mm-hmm.
which you're doing right now. Fat and all.
Mm. Extremely tasty.
Mm. What comes into your mind as you eat this or eat other kinds of meat?
That we don't have, we don't eat duck very often. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. For me, eating duck is a treat.
Yeah.
It reminds me, my father was also, on top of being a fisherman, was also a hunter. So we would have live game and we...
Fresh game.
Probably. Fresh game. Sorry, not
live game. I love the idea of you running around the kitchen with ducks and squirrels running after you.
But we would have, not necessarily duck, but we would have...
Grouse. Partridge.
Partridge and...
Pheasant.
Pheasant. Pheasant.
Mm, lucky.
Which was absolutely delicious.
Yeah, there's some great game in Quebec.
Yeah. So this dark, gamey meat is very much up my memory tree, in a way, if I could call that.
In your memory tree?
Yes, yes. My memory tree.
Your memory. That's a beautiful image.
Where I have good memories of eating gamey meats. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is gamey. It's very dark red. Mm-hmm. I mean, it speaks to the ways that the breast tissue of ducks are used extensively, and that it's very dense in hemoglobin, presumably. And so then when it's cured, it turns into that gorgeous kind of dark purple.
Mm-hmm. And a little goes a long way, I find.
Well, that's why I basically, before we met, I was basically having cured meat and almost no other fresh meat. I would get my meat intake through charcuterie because it just seemed like it was a more delicious way to eat a smaller amount of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think it is, but now we've slipped a bit back into fresh meat and cured meat. So when you eat a piece of meat, whether it's chicken or pork or beef or cured duck breast, does it give you a kind of emotional or affective feeling, something that you could describe in words? Like I'm being theoretical here, but it's also, you know, this is one of the reasons people like eating meat. It gives them a feeling of something or other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you ever have that feeling or a feeling that is emotional as much as gustatory.
That's a very good question. Yes, sometimes I do, depending on the type of meat it is and the way it was actually cooked. I'm a big, big fan of mijoté, stews or meat that have been cooked for a very long time in the oven that are fall apart. I find something so satisfying, and then all of a sudden this regular piece of meat is kind of magnified, and that's what I love. If it is a very, very good piece of meat, like a tartare, I enjoy it as well. But there's something about, slow cooked meat that rings my bell.
Rings your bell. So it's kind of the magic transformation of a relatively inexpensive cut into something absolutely delicious.
Yes.
The way that the meat reveals its beauty over time.
Absolutely. That's what I love.
When I eat meat, I feel
incredibly lucky or privileged. That's the sense that comes over me. I feel I enjoy it a lot because I feel like I am very, very fortunate to be here right now.
Oh, we are.
We are. Yeah. 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 We are privileged above all else.
Yes.
And also sometimes lucky. Well, thank you for cutting to the meat of the matter in this conversation, my dear.
Very welcome.
And I'll look forward to meeting you again soon.
Bye for now.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Our languages are heavily larded with references to meat of all sorts. From the indelible Wendy's advertising slogan turned political rallying call, "Where's the beef?" to the countless references to people being as scared as chickens, stubborn as goats, or gentle as lambs, we humans are fairly addicted to our carno-linguistics. One of the notable aspects of our meat vocabulary is the way in which the word for the animal is sometimes the same as the flesh we harvest from its body, but it's also often different. Think fish and fish or rabbit and rabbit, but conversely, cow and beef or deer and venison, not to mention pig and pork. If you look to other languages for comparisons, it can give a clue as to why some of these differences occur. According to food and language scholars, one of the reasons is that, depending on who raised the animal and who ate the flesh, differences in class and language were responsible for the differences in naming. That's one of the reasons that French and English are so different, for example, and highlights that meat eating has been, in past, very stratified. Not eating meat also constitutes a pretty fascinating history. Numerous religions and ethno-cultural groups have long abstained from eating meat, even when the economic means to consume it were available to them. For many, it related to practicing nonviolence towards animals, as well as a belief in not ingesting the life force of other creatures. In kosher dietary rules, meat is not prohibited, but consuming blood is, since blood is considered to be life itself. This means that animals need to be koshered when slaughtered, that is, fully drained of their blood so that no trace remains before they're eaten. It also means that eating animals of prey is not kosher, since you'd be eating something that ate another animal's life force. Intriguingly, much of what defines halal eating, that is, the Islamic dietary laws, is quite similar to kosher rules, though there are also many distinctions as well. Over the last 500 years or so, eating and not eating meat has also been enmeshed with moral and philosophical and political movements, adding to the complexity of carnivory. A formal vegetarian society was established in England in 1847, and vegetarianism has frequently been associated with abstaining from or resisting dominant political structures. Women's suffrage and early feminist movements often incorporated vegetarian discourse and messages. Meat and masculinity and politics, and of course the centralization of power within a small number of individuals, are all entangled with each other, and today's debates on eating animal foods cannot be separated from this really very dense history. Whether you eat meat or not, or eat it sometimes, is therefore a personal choice that also has many political and environmental and physiological implications. It's not a neutral or straightforward act. It is, like everything to do with food, an effect of a whole world of influences, both internal, external, and also relational. Are we all going to stop eating meat one day for the good of the planet and our own bodies? Nope. Should we? Probably not. Should we reflect on and wonder about and reevaluate our assumptions and habits and tastes, however? Yes. 100% yes, 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 and yes. But take your time with it. It's very definitely a chicken and egg conundrum. Moving away from meat metaphors and putting down the pork puns for a moment, we turn now to the food questionnaire. Our respondent comes from the UK and, once again, the world of physics and public health. Her responses made me sit up and say, huh, a few times, and I'm indebted to them for the way they've helped me think about this episode. Liz Ainsbury is a radiation protection physicist who works with colleagues from around the world as the head of the Radiation Effects Department and the deputy head of the science and engineering profession for the UK Health Security Agency. When Liz and I recorded her answers to the questionnaire, she described herself as being a scientist, a mother, and a runner. Liz, what is your idea of a perfect food?
After 25 years as a vegetarian, the last 5 years I've been vegan. So my perfect meal is definitely in a setting where I know, where I'm absolutely sure that what I'm eating is vegan.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
similarly to my previous answer, I'm very suspicious when I don't know whether food is vegan or not. So if I'm absolutely sure it's vegan, then I'm happy. If I'm not, then I'm a little bit suspicious, perhaps.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Equity and kindness and perhaps support for those who have less.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Greed or perhaps nationalism.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
For my 10th wedding anniversary, my husband and I went to Fat Duck restaurant, and we spent more money on a single meal than we usually spend on groceries and eating out in a month. I would do it again, maybe for the 20th wedding anniversary.
For what do you hunger?
Usually, I am looking forward to whatever my next meal is going to be.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
Fusion food, or in particular the backlash against it. For me, food is, or food should be, just food. So people who cook all the time borrow from other cultures and update their knowledge, so there shouldn't ever really be an issue with that.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
Very infrequently. I have done this when I was offered something not vegan and I didn't want to explain why, but mostly I'm fairly open about why I eat what I eat and why I don't eat what I don't eat.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
Definitely the formality.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Refreshing.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
Still attached to a live animal, ideally.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Any kind of chili seasoning or chili sauce. I very rarely eat a meal without some form of chili.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
I love spending time in something beautiful, colourful, and peaceful.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
Well, most of the time I can these days make things that taste good. My presentation skills are terrible. So I'd really love to be able to make things that look beautiful as well as taste good.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
I think perhaps that processed foods had a better balance of nutrition. This could be done very easily, I think, but I guess it isn't cheap, which is why this isn't the case.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
Anytime I make a healthy, balanced meal that tastes really good, and both of my children and my husband eat it.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
I would probably go with chili sauce. That way I'd be able to hang around for a bit and bring joy to those who could handle me.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
We have a really good set of sharp knives, and they are absolutely invaluable.
What do you most value in your friends' food?
When they take time to prepare something that's vegan, especially for me.
Who are your favorite food writers?
So I have several books of the Bosch brand and also Dirty Vegan, and I really enjoy the regular articles in The Guardian by the vegan cook Meera Sodder. I think she's brilliant.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
So my family and I love the Great British Bake Off, particularly my son, who's 10 and is always wanting us to try and recreate some of these beautiful bakes.
What is your most powerful sense?
This is something I've never thought about. I'd go with perhaps touch or maybe taste. These are the senses that bring me the most pleasure anyway.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
Gastronomic is a great word, and also anything suitable for vegans.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
Perhaps some people found her a little too spicy?
And that's it for this meat-minded episode of Making a Meal of It. Thank you so much to Julie Guthman, Phil Vien, Liz Ainsbury, and Maxime Giroux. To the animals I eat, I offer my wholehearted respect and appreciation, my gratitude and recognition of their lives. To all the vegetables and fruits and grains as well, I send my same salutations. Everything has a life force in it, after all, and we should probably think more about that more often. Not just at the end of recording or listening to a podcast. Take a look at the show notes for some readings and references to chew on, and don't forget to like and review the show, please. A quick click and kind word for your meat puppet podcaster is always appreciated. Coming up in a week, we dive into the deep blue depths of fish and fisheries, another food space where things get pretty fluid. For so many years, we've been told to eat more fish, that it's better for us, and that it's delicious. So we did. And now the oceans are emptying, and the rivers are drying up, and the offshore fish farms are polluting what's left of our waterways. Wow, that is gloomy. But there's also some glimmers of hope, ones that are a bit more than just a fish tale. We'll hear from a fisheries scholar focused on small-scale and traditional fishing systems, and a fish farmer who operates in the urban center of Montreal. And of course, Maxime will eat something he doesn't much care for. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, kiapai tokai and chenam vestram fruimini.